This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before it was embraced by celebrities, chefs, and an estimated 16 million Americans, veganism meant radicalism, like the animal rights activists who throw red paint on women wearing fur, a tactic picked up by the Sex and the City movie.
Fur is murder!
A number of vegans have labored to distance themselves from that image, setting off a schism that has divided the movement for 15 years. One camp follows an all-or-nothing imperative to eliminate the commodification and consumption of animals and animal products. The other is working to make strategic, incremental changes in food policy, production, and preferences. Chase Purdy is a New York-based journalist who writes about food for Quartz. That's where we found his article about the divergent paths of the vegan movement. And Chase, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So a shift within the vegan movement started stirring in 2000, then this split in 2001. What was behind it?
So what was really behind that was for at least three decades, the vegan movement really sort of was one note in many respects. People who drove this movement had a very sort of specific ideology that it was either, it was a black and white, either no animal products or animal products. People need to make a choice, and it was a moral imperative to choose living life without these animal products. And about seven people in 2000 basically thought that they could accomplish more by approaching this differently. And so it started with them. They were mostly in Washington, D.C. They were all friends, and they decided to approach the vegan movement with the idea that they would be able to accomplish more by driving for incremental change.
And incremental change meaning what?
Meaning that, well, for starters, that instead of focusing on so many different areas in veganism, like the fur fashion industry and how animals were used in labs, they would focus on one thing, farm animal welfare. The idea behind that was that most animals in the United States are part of the farm animal system. And so by driving for policy changes at the state and federal level, that they would be able to do the most good for the most animals.
By getting people to eat less meat?
That's part of the strategy, yes. There are a few examples of this that come to mind, and that is in 2008, there was a ballot measure in California that was going to basically change the requirements that egg farmers had for the sizes of their cages. That measure passed in California with overwhelming support. In February of 2014, the Humane Society, which is a major player in this effort, partnered with the United Egg Producers to try and put in the U.S. Farm Bill a provision that would also tackle some requirements for cage sizes for laying hens. That, fortunately for them, didn't really work. It got torpedoed by other interests at play. But it's another example, this time on the federal policy level, like how they're driving for change, they're trying to make lives better for laying hens. And then we saw it this year in November when in Massachusetts, another ballot initiative passed, again with overwhelming support, 78%, to create a requirement that any egg, pork, chicken, poultry of any kind sold in the state, that those animals had to come from housing arrangements that allowed them to stand up, turn around, stretch their wings, move more freely. And that passed. That got support. So you can really see over the last, since 2008 all the way through this year, just a massive amount of effort being put towards changing policies.
You follow the trajectory of this small clan of pragmatists, some of them working on changing policies. You just talked about lobbying policy, making inroads with investment banks, undercover investigations, and also founding a well-known eggless condiments company. So a number of different strategies. How is this pragmatic side of the vegan movement doing compared to the more, let's say, absolutists?
Right. So the interesting thing about this handful of people who really dug in 2000 and drove this movement is that you can really track the changes that they've been able to make as they've gone through this past 16 years. One of them just this year founded a lobbying institute in Washington, D.C. that represents the interests of sort of plant-based and meat alternative food products. Another one helps mastermind writing these ballot initiatives that are being put in front of voters across the country. Another one is talking to major investment banks here in New York, Morgan Stanley, ING, BlackRock, and trying to sort of convince people in the investment community and the finance community to care about animal welfare from a very sort of pragmatic financial perspective. Another one of them has gone on to really dig in and do sort of undercover investigations so that, in her view, that people know how animals are being treated on this farm level. And then, as you mentioned, yeah, that one of them has gone on to found Hampton Creek, which is a very well-known eggless condiments company. They have a product called Just Mayo that has gotten some notoriety through the years.
We're talking about a definitive split in the vegan movement that happened right at the beginning of this century and created two very divergent paths forward. Chase Purdy is with us. He's a New York-based journalist who writes about food for Quartz. I want to pick up on this idea of the Massachusetts ballot initiative because, you know, it just happened. 78% of the voters, as you said, supported that prohibition. Now, I imagine the kind of, you know, agitating that can be done by lobbyists or in back rooms. But that means the support of a number of voters, we're assuming a lot of them non-vegans. How did they pull that off?
Right. So a major part of the strategy for, you know, this sort of pragmatic vein of the movement is really appealing to people's sort of everyday sensibilities, in a lot of ways sort of the emotional side of how our food is produced in this country. That includes issues like, should piglets have their tails cut off without anesthesia, or should an egg-laying hen or a pregnant pig, a sow, be crammed into a cage where they can barely move? And, you know, what I have learned from the people who are driving this movement and what they say that they are hearing is that, you know, by and large, people don't want to be eating food that comes at the expense of animal suffering. And at least in the Massachusetts example, 78% of the voters on Election Day supported that ballot measure. So they seem to be able to really be convincing people that this is the future, that there will be specific standards for the husbandry practices from where their food comes from.
Well, that's also Massachusetts, you know, a notably liberal state. And if we can divide, you know, food production in the Midwest, in Texas, in California, there are these huge farms and the scale is so much bigger than places like Massachusetts. What difference does a small state like that actually make in egg production, for example?
So that's sort of what makes this ballot effort so interesting on the part of the Humane Society, is that they have really found a way to change the system without appealing directly to the food companies that are responsible for producing a lot of the food that's in this country. They have figured out that if they can go into urban areas and appeal to a great number of people, they can basically change the food system from outside the heartland where food is made. So, for instance, in Massachusetts, there are about 6.7 million people in Massachusetts. There aren't a lot of egg farms, but if Massachusetts residents are willing to support a measure that says we're not going to buy eggs or pork or chicken that came from animals that couldn't be caged, then a farmer out in Iowa really has to make a decision. If I want to tap into that huge market on the East Coast, then I'm going to have to change my practices here in Middle America. And that's sort of really that's the tactic that's being used here. And for now, it appears to be working.
Chase, this pragmatic model that was kind of championed by these seven dissidents from the vegan movement, lobbying, corporate culture, you know, investment, working on ballot initiatives, that's a pretty high bar for a lot of activist movements. Do you think it's something that is replicable?
So I think that the answer to that question really is sort of left to be seen here. It was actually kind of interesting that as I was finishing up this story, that it kind of coincided with the election. And, you know, just it's, you see it on social media, you hear it on the streets. There are a lot of people in this country that are talking about how they can create change, how they can start movements. And it would not surprise me if there are lessons to be learned in this specific movement story, in the vegan movement story. Is it perfectly replicable? Probably not, but it certainly is proof that in many cases, striving strategically for incremental change in the right zones can be a very effective method to spark change and to gather a following along with it.
How about that popular image of vegans throwing red paint or chaining themselves to farm posts? Is that outdated?
So that's sort of beyond my scope of expertise in this area, for sure. I think that those movements definitely have played a role in drawing attention to an issue. I think a lot of those people who do prescribe to those methods have a really deeply held conviction for why they are doing that. In terms of whether or not that drives the most actual change, I think that that's sort of what's debatable here. And I think that sort of this pragmatic movement within veganism shows, or at least offers a pretty compelling example, that there is a better way to approach people. One of those pragmatists that I talked to, her name was Mayun Park, you know, she used to be in that movement. She was one of those people, and she told me that she used to lock herself to anything and everything she could, that she screamed like I wouldn't believe, that she even got arrested so many times. And she said she loved it, and she misses it because there's nothing like feeling that you're 100% right. But then she sort of added that when she looks back now, she feels like she sort of messed up because she thinks of all the people that she maybe turned away by acting like that. And I think that that is an interesting point that she makes. And I think that that serves kind of as an example that perhaps that absolutist movement isn't going to serve or make the most change, even if it is drawing attention.
Chase Purdy, he's a New York-based journalist who writes about food for quartz. Thank you for speaking with us.
No, thanks for having me.
You can read his article about the two divergent vegan movements. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.